This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Coming up, organizers of the Morro Bay Bird Festival talk about upcoming events.
We doubled up on events, having 259 events. Right now, we have over 100 that are still available.
Also, the challenges facing undocumented immigrants living on the Central Coast.
In the Central Coast, undocumented immigrants face fear of retaliation from their employers, wage theft, especially if you're working in the agricultural industry, fear of deportation, and then also systemic racism.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, January 6th, 2025. I'm Meher Ali. Let's start with Brian Reynolds.
Today we are joined by Tanya Israel, professor of counseling psychology at University of California at Santa Barbara and author of Facing the Fracture, How to Navigate the Challenges of Living in a Divided Nation. Welcome, Tanya.
Thanks so much, Brian. I'm delighted to be here.
I'm super excited about this book and talking to you because I can't imagine a topic more timely here in the waning days of 2024. Could you tell us a little bit about who you are and how you came to write this book, please?
I'm going to start a little while ago. Back in the mid-1990s, I started a group to bring together pro-choice and pro-life people to have dialogue with each other. And it was a transformational experience for me. Didn't change anything about how I felt about reproductive rights, but it changed so much about how I felt about people who disagreed with me on it. And I really carried that experience forward with me into my career, where I have primarily been doing research on LGBTQ psychology. And that's brought me into contact with plenty of people who do not see eye to eye with me. And then after the 2016 election, it was clear that we were having so much trouble as a country connecting across the divide. And I'm a counseling psychologist, so my first question was, what can I do to help? And I started creating resources and teaching workshops on dialogue skills. And that led to my first book, Beyond Your Bubble, which was about how to have dialogue across political differences. And many people found that to be helpful and exactly what they needed. And then there were people who said, you know, I don't want to talk to those people, or dialogue is just not my concern, but I'm still kind of losing it. What do you got for me? And so that's how I kept doing the work and wrote Facing the Fracture, How to Navigate the Challenges of Living in a Divided Nation, which came out this year. And so that takes us up to right now.
You know, there's an interesting observation I heard once many years ago about the role of lawyers and attorneys. And it's not the stupid joke things that people think. Mediators and attorneys are brought in when people can't solve a problem by themselves without the resources. So I'm thinking that a person like yourself, not just an academic, but a practicing psychologist, is exactly the type of person we need at this time in history. Would you agree?
Well, I love bringing together the research, which I am really pulling from so many different sources, people who are doing the research in media studies, in psychology, in a lot of different fields, to then pull out what are the practical things that we can do. So I like to be evidence-based and accessible and really practical. So I think that's a great convergence to try to support people right now when they're feeling so stressed and distressed about politics and about division.
What do you think are some of the major causes of the division, both actual and perceived, in the late 2020s? What do you think about that?
So, you know, when we talk about polarization, people often think that we're talking about differences of views, like how far apart our opinions are. And that's what we call ideological polarization, which has increased a little bit over time. But what has actually increased dramatically over the last few years is what we call affective polarization. And that's the animosity and the vitriol, the mistrust that we are feeling toward people on the other side of the political spectrum. And so I'm really interested in what has caused that problem, because it makes sense that we have different views. In a healthy democracy, there should be a range of views, but it doesn't seem to help to have these corrosive attitudes toward people on the other side. And, you know, some of that comes from just what's built into our brains as human beings. We evolved as human beings living in small groups of people, and we were protecting ourselves and each other, not just from saber-toothed tigers, but also from the other tribes who were in competition for resources, who were really, truly a threat to our very existence. And we are taking these old brains and overlaying them onto our current situation. And then, you know, media and social media, they feed that, but then we also just gobble it up because these narratives about, you know, people on the other side being so extreme and hostile just fits in really well to those built-in biases that we have based on our evolution.
So what I hear you saying, we had things that were baked into our brains, our bodies, our behaviors, our lives thousands of years ago that were appropriate for the time and the circumstances, but not so much any longer. We're dealing with modern problems with old-time resources. Is that accurate?
Yes, you've got it exactly right. So when we are encountering something that feels like a threat, we experience it as if it's a saber-toothed tiger, even if it's simply somebody who has a different view, who, you know, might be speaking in a loud voice or might not even be. It could even be a lawn sign or a hat that we're reacting to. But it kicks our body into this fight or flight mode, which, if we stay in that state for a long period of time, it's really bad for our health and our mental health. And so that's part of what people are experiencing with the stress right now.
I'm guessing that self-awareness is a big part of this, to be aware of the tendency to be tribal when being collegial or communal is a better approach. And I'm noting here that being aware of oneself is a difficult task. It's a slippery item, but at least it's something that is somewhat under our control as opposed to someone acting upon us. Does that hold water there?
Absolutely. You know, I hear people talk a lot about what the elected officials should do and what the media conglomerates should do and what social media companies should do. And there are a lot of things we could want others to do, but I always think it's most empowering to identify what we can actually do. And so things like limiting our intake of emotionally activating news and social media, things like recognizing when we have a cognitive bias that's coming into play as we're thinking about people on the other side of the spectrum. And so things like that are things that we do have some control over. And I really find it useful to focus on those kinds of things.
Another guest I interviewed recently, he is a medical doctor who deals with issues of anger and pain, and noting, for example, that when you're angry, your body is full of nasty chemicals, like you're adrenalized and your higher faculties tend to shut down or slow down when you're in a mood like that, and logic and reason don't have a lot about it. But it seems to me that if we spend too much time looking into the darkness, you know, taken liberally, there's a lot of darkness on the internet, that it might be just a bad habit.
I think we can absolutely think about it in terms of our habits and trying to develop habits that will help us in a divided time. But these are the same habits that will help us no matter what. We're always going to be encountering people who are different from ourselves, who maybe think differently or have different experiences or values. We're going to be faced with challenges in our lives. And as technology and social media gets more and more embedded in our society, we have to figure out what do we want our relationship with it to look like. And so all of those are things that we can have some kind of control over. And that's going to help us in the worst times, but even in the best times, it'll help us to be better parents, better partners, better community members. And so I think, you know, even though it's so distressing what we're going through right now, maybe it will bring our attention to some of those things that will be helpful in the long run.
There's a Israeli psychologist, Daniel Kahneman, that I'm fascinated with. I read a couple of his books, and one is called Thinking Fast and Slow. And our fast, quick, analysis brain is probably, you know, the part that would help us recognize threats in ancient times. And maybe one answer to that is simply slowing down.
And it does seem like that's helpful as we're trying to evaluate our media environment, because we're just overwhelmed these days with all the media and the notifications from our phones and the 24-hour news channels. But it turns out that when we actually do slow down a little bit, we can recognize when something is misinformation or disinformation, or even if it's something that's just kind of designed to push our buttons and, well, really get us to push buttons back. And so slowing down is a great way to do that. And it's never what's going to come from media and social media. They're not trying to get us to slow down. It's something that we can really do ourselves.
I'd like to remind everyone, I am Brian Reynolds for KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today we are joined by Dr. Tanya Israel, professor of counseling psychology at University of California at Santa Barbara, discussing her brand new book, Facing the Fracture, How to Navigate the Challenges of Living in a Divided Nation. It seems to me that the media is driven by profit, which is pretty true of companies in a capitalist system. There's nothing inherently wrong with that. But it seems to me that if the method of making money on the internet involves having eyes on a website, clicking on in a direction that you're being surveilled and monitored as you do that, that there's money to be made by stoking people's fears, by having them focus on negative stuff because there's more clicks. I mean, maybe it's just as simple as that.
Oh, absolutely. You know, media companies are just trying to survive. I mean, local media is actually really under threat. It's disappearing in many places. And so I can understand why media is trying to keep us engaged. And if we start to turn our focus to engaging in things that are positive stories, you know, one of the things that I do is focus on what's going on with bridging efforts. So people who are really trying to connect across political divides. There's actually a movement of more than 500 organizations that are working on bridging divides and strengthening our democracy. And, you know, if you go to the listenfirstproject.org, you'll find out a lot about all of those organizations. And so that's who I follow. That's the podcast that I listen to. And it makes me so much more optimistic. It gives me faith in my fellow Americans and hope for the future of our country. There are things that we can really turn our focus to that are going to put us in a better frame of mind to navigate the challenges.
One of the things I like to stress in these interviews is misconceptions, falsehoods that are taken as fact. What would be some of your top misconceptions about what you're trying to do and what those misconceptions or maybe social myths that you're trying to dispel?
People often think that when we're dealing with political division, that dialogue is really the answer. And, you know, this may sound odd coming from someone who wrote a whole book about how to have dialogue. I think that dialogue is a tremendous asset, but it can't be the only thing that we're trying to do, because we're coming in with these preconceptions already about other people that are making us avoid dialogue or making us very bad at when we do try to do it. So we often need to start at a different place. We often need to start not with the people in our midst, but the people in our minds. How we're thinking about those other people, recognizing the biases that we might have. There's three cognitive biases that I think are particularly challenging for us right now. And one is confirmation bias, which causes us to focus on information that supports what we already believe to be true and ignore or dismiss information that conflicts with our existing beliefs. And that leads us to see ourselves as right and other people as ignorant. And then there's also one called naive realism, and that's where we see ourselves as objective and we see others as biased, but it's very hard for us to see our own biases. The one that I actually think is most corrosive is called motive attribution asymmetry. And this is the one where we see our own motives as being benevolent and caring. And we see the other group as being driven by hate and selfishness and aggression. And so knowing that these biases exist, and if we can adjust for that, if we can correct those misperceptions, it puts us in a much better state. So that would be the first misconception broadly, which is that, you know, dialogue isn't necessarily the answer or the place to start. And then a lot of other misconceptions come out of those underlying biases that we have.
One of my favorite concepts that I didn't really discover or think about it until I was an adult is the term emotional intelligence, which one definition for is simply being aware of other people's moods and needs rather than focusing on our own. And they can be super instructive. All hope that our EQ would be at least on par with our IQ.
Absolutely. You know, people really want to trust the science, and they'll do that up to the point where the science tells them that what they need to do is to have more empathy for people who disagree with them, or to manage their emotions that come up when their buttons are being pushed. EQ is a really great approach to take. The other thing that I really love is on really more of a thinking level, which is intellectual humility. And intellectual humility is where we are respectful of and curious about the views that other people have, even when we have very strongly held or even extreme views. We can still want to know more about other people's. And I also think that's a very empowering place. So if on an emotional level, we're tuned in to other people, and if on a thought level, we are really seeing other people as resources to help us understand another view rather than as threats to our perspective, that puts us in a really great frame of mind.
In my profession, which was librarianship, one of my favorite sayings is a wise person is always confused. You know, another thought that I got from another recent interview guest, another physician in this case, is that because most of us are not very self-aware, maybe 80% of our what's going on behind our own screens is subconscious and yet has a huge role, especially that's where our emotions lie and what pushes us in directions that we're not really sure. Then we intellectualize and rationalize around it, saying, oh, that's why I'm doing that, because of this and that. But it's really just an emotional push. But anyways, is to actually seek out others and their evaluation of the person, especially your friends. And this is the part that really blew me away. Talk to your enemies. Find out how they see you, if you can do that. And you're going to really get an interesting portrait of yourself.
I think that it certainly helps us to see how others might see us. I think another great question to ask our enemies, or, you know, people who we disagree with, is to say, what is it that I am misunderstanding about you? Or what is it that people on my side don't really get about people on your side? And that, I think, can give us tremendous insight about really what we're missing.
Are we needing venues where people can do that in an environment that's non-threatening and congenial? Because I can't think of very many except for the dog park.
Oh, well, the dog park is a great place to go. And, you know, the great thing about a dog park is that everybody has something in common. They like dogs. And any time that we can find something that we have in common with somebody else, whether it's, you know, dogs or your favorite TV show or breakfast burritos, whatever it is that we can find some common ground, that helps us to really build a foundation and a connection where we eventually might go to talk about politics, but not necessarily. The other thing that I'll say is that there are so many venues for this that we might not be aware of, because really the bridging movement is, I think, not being covered nearly enough by the media. So there's things like Braver Angels, which is an organization that brings together people on the red side and the blue side. There's a great project that happened this summer called Raft for America, where they actually took people who leaned red and leaned blue and put them on whitewater rafts together, which sounds like it could be a very dangerous thing to do. But it turns out that when you have people engaging with other three-dimensional human beings and working toward a common goal, then that will be a great recipe for connection and collaboration.
That's so exciting and inspirational. I am Brian Reynolds for KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today we were joined by Dr. Tanya Israel, professor of counseling psychology at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and author of a new book, Facing the Fracture, How to Navigate the Challenges of Living in a Divided Nation.
This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Meher Ali. Up next, Carol Tangeman talks to Bob Revel and Susie Reddy about all the exciting activities and events that they have lined up for this year's Morro Bay Bird Festival.
We've been looking forward to this for a long time. It's good to have this conversation with you. We spoke right before registration opened because some of the events sell out right away. And now we are getting closer to the event. It's Thursday, January 16th through Monday, the 20th. So, Bob, how is registration going at this point?
Registration is going incredibly good. We had a huge turnout on November 2nd, the day that we opened. About 80% of the people who are attending registered on that opening day. But since then, we've had a large number of people registering. Right now, we have 858 people registered, and by the time we register our full staff, which includes leaders, volunteers, and committee members, we'll have over 1,000 people at this event walking around with a badge on.
Oh, that's so nice. And how many are local people traveling? Where are they traveling from?
We have about 26 states that are represented right now, 26 of the 50 states. We have people coming from as far away as Maine and New Hampshire, Vermont, Minnesota, Montana, and they cannot wait to get to Morro Bay in January.
I can imagine. The weather has been fabulous, and
yes.
January is usually so lovely in Morro Bay.
Yes.
And so the Morro Bay Bird Festival is considered one of the top five bird festivals in the nation, so no wonder they're all coming.
Yes, and we have incredible VIPs, we call them, coming this year to attract those. We have Ken Kaufman and his wife Kimberly. We have David Lindo, the urban birder, coming over from the UK. And we have Rebecca Heisman coming down from Walla Walla, Washington.
So to the non-birders, yeah. Ken and Kimberly Kaufman are...
They are big names in the sense that they've been involved in writing field guides and leading trips and writing books. Very well-known people in the birding world.
Okay. And yeah. John Dunn, master birder. What's a taxonomic expert?
So John Dunn is also a field guide author, and he's an expert on bird families. So
okay.
taxonomy is... what birds are in what families.
Got it.
And if you want the really detailed scientific information, John Dunn's your guy.
Okay.
One more thing I want to drop back about registration. Of the 858 people coming, over 60% of those live outside our 934 zip code, which means they're coming, they need a place to stay, they need food to eat, and so it's a big boost to the local economy.
Yeah, and at least from what I can tell with the events scattered all over the Central Coast and possibly some places that, you know, feel like they're even a little further, that's going to be spread out.
Yes, we cover the entire county. We go as far north as Piedras Blancas, the Lighthouse Tower, and we go east out to the Kern National Wildlife Refuge and also Carrizo Plain. We go south down to Oso Flacco Lake, and then we have pelagic trips going out into the ocean.
Oh, gosh, this sounds great. Susie, what is your position with the
I am the community outreach chair with the Morro Bay Bird Festival. So I am in charge of helping to promote the festival to the local community and also working with the local businesses in Morro Bay to help promote the festival to them and to promote those businesses to our attendees. As Bob said, a lot of our attendees come from outside our county, so they're spending money here, and we really want them to utilize our local businesses.
Absolutely.
So we work closely with the Morro Bay Chamber of Commerce to do that. We also work with the City of Morro Bay and Visit Morro Bay, which is the Get Salty folks. As you drive into Morro Bay, see their billboard.
Love that.
So that's my job. And then we also have been participating in a lot of community events where they had vendors available. So a lot of listeners have probably seen us out and about this fall promoting the festival.
Right. And what are you excited about?
I'm really excited about our Community Family Day and our Vendor Bazaar. Those are both free events that are open to the public. You do not need to sign up. So if signing up and registering in advance feels stressful or you're not sure, just come by. So our Vendor Bazaar is at the Community Center. It's Friday, January 17th, Saturday the 18th, and Sunday the 19th. We have a bunch of art that will be for sale. We have several tour companies that will be there. And we have six optics companies that will be there. Optics meaning binoculars and spotting scopes.
Oh.
Yes, which is really cool. So if you have binoculars and you might want to upgrade, or if you've never bought binoculars and don't know anything about it, this is the time to do that. You can come and meet the representatives, be hands-on, and really see how the products feel.
Yeah.
I don't know that there's really anywhere else in the county that you can do that.
Right, and compare and feel what's just right for your needs.
Yeah.
And if, let's say, someone has been so busy they haven't even heard of the Morro Bay Bird Festival yet, they can still come to these events.
Yes. And I would actually encourage locals, Family Day, which is Saturday, January 18th from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m., that would be the best time to come. It's super fun. It was like a big party last year. We have a bunch of make and take nature crafts for kids. Everyone's welcome, but the crafts are really great for, I'd say, elementary aged children and their families. We have a bunch of our nonprofit partners. So other environmental nonprofit organizations will be in the Vendor Bazaar. They will also have crafts. So parents are encouraged to go in the bazaar, do some shopping, meet those representatives from those organizations. And very excitingly, Pacific Wildlife Care will be there. Some of their wildlife ambassadors will be inside the Vendor Bazaar. So that is really exciting. I don't know which ones will be there this year, but last year I think we had a common raven, a Virginia opossum, a gopher snake, and an American kestrel that you can see up close, really cool.
That is fun.
Yeah, it's very fun. So if you have no idea who we are or what we're doing, that's the day to come.
If you're just joining us, this is KCBX Public Radio. You're listening to Issues and Ideas. We're talking about the Morro Bay Bird Festival coming up January 16th to the 20th. And with me, Susie Reddy and Bob Revel. What are some of the exciting events that are still available?
We've got it all.
Yeah.
Last year, we had 200 events at our festival. This year, we scheduled 259 events. We're trying to grow the festival and also have trips available for people who register later on. I mentioned earlier that about 80% of the people register on the opening day. And in the past, when we didn't have enough events, all the good events got gone on the first day. Now we have so many events. We've doubled up and tripled up on events, having 259 events. Right now we have over 100 of the 259 that are still available. Still
have
space
wonderful.
Available. Yes.
Okay.
And they do include lazy birding, birding by kayak, our pelagic trips out into the ocean are still open. Today we had a trip open up that's with one of our VIPs, David Lindo. So we've got a lot of good stuff that's still out there, and we are getting one or two registrations in every day. And what we're hoping for is that we have a lot of people come in on site at the festival and register.
Yeah.
And just maybe go on an event that day.
Yeah, that's probably something that, local people would really, really enjoy.
Yes.
Everyone's talking about the bird flu right now. And I'm wondering, has this been an issue at all with the bird festival? Have you had anyone even ask about it with registration?
Well, as far as the bird festival goes, it's not an issue. It's a non-issue because we don't handle birds.
Right.
A lot of people have wondered, can I come to the bird festival and see a parrot sitting on someone's shoulder? And we go, no, we go look at real birds, the birds in the wild. So it is not an issue for us.
Okay. Good to know. Are there any special events that you want to talk about?
We do have two keynote addresses on Saturday and Sunday night. These will be taking place at Cuesta College. But on Friday night, we have a special showing of a movie called Condor Canyon. It's about a pair of condors that were raising a young up in the Ventana. And the producer of that film, Kelly Sorensen, is going to be here. And it's going to be a special premiere at the Bay Theater in Morro Bay. And tickets are available for $10. And you can get those through our website.
Mm-hmm. And your website is morrobaybirdfestival.org.
Yes, it is.
All right. It's such a great site.
We have a very talented committee member who has really great graphics skill. Yeah. Her name's Jeanette Stone. She does our website, and she's got a great eye for design.
So anything else that you want to add for our listeners?
I would add to amplify what Susie said about the bazaar is that if you are thinking about getting any type of optics, that you do come to our event because it's after Christmas and after holiday sales, and the prices are really, really good.
Okay.
And I would like to add one more thing. After the festival in 2024, we sent a survey out to all our participants, which was really cool to hear how they felt about the festival. And one thing that came through very loud and clear, people love Morro Bay. They love San Luis Obispo County. They raved about how beautiful it is here, which we know as locals. And they really like the local community. They loved how warm and friendly people are in our county. And, you know, we are a nonprofit organization. We're all volunteers. We do this because we love it. And we could not do this event without the support of the community. So as a member of the committee, I just want to express that to the county and to all the locals. Thank you for supporting our event. People love coming here. Oh. And we're very lucky to live here.
We are so lucky to live
yes.
here. Although I will say, it seems like all of the information you put out about this event is clear and well done. So I can see why
you
guys are so popular with this event. Well, Susie Reddy, final thoughts from you.
I just really want to welcome the community to please come check out the festival. If you have no idea what birding is, you've always heard about our event and wondered what exactly we're doing, which I've heard from a lot of people, just come by the community center Friday, Saturday, or Sunday. It's free. It's open to the public. You can meet us. You can see what we're doing. And hopefully you'll decide to attend an event either this year or next year.
Yeah, because I mean, I think of birding, I used to think that it was only for people who had the expensive cameras and binoculars. But I find, you know, with most of our phones, we can take some pretty nice pictures.
Yes.
And I know there is an event about taking pictures.
Digiscoping. We call it digiscoping.
And one really important thing is youth 17 and under can register for free.
Oh.
And we have some events that are specifically geared towards young people.
Yeah, we have a number of trips for young people that are led by young people. We have some bay cruises. We have some walks along Morro Strand Beach and also in Los Osos at Sweet Springs.
And some are led by young people.
They are all
yes.
led by young people.
I love
people.
That.
So if there's any local teens listening or their parents are listening and you're interested, please go to our website and check that out. You can sign up for free, and we'd love to have you come.
All right. Something for everyone. The Morro Bay Bird Festival, morrobaybirdfestival.org, and it is coming up. It's Thursday, January 16th through Monday, the 20th. It is considered one of the top five bird festivals in the nation. We are lucky to have it here. Well, thank you both for joining me, Susie Reddy and Bob Revel.
This is KCBX, public radio for the Central Coast, and you're listening to Issues and Ideas. I'm Meher Ali. Up next, you may have already heard our next guest on the air. Mario Espinoza-Kulik is the co-host of Central Coast Voices. He is also a researcher and faculty at the Ethnic Studies Department in Cuesta College. I ask him about some of the challenges facing immigrant communities living on the Central Coast and their concerns as the new administration takes office.
Welcome, Mario.
Thank you, Meher. Glad to be here.
You've done research with indigenous communities, but also Latinx communities. Can you clarify how Latinx is different from someone saying they're Latina or Latino?
It's not that different at all. I think for folks that are either Latine, Latina, Latino, Latinx, it's a spectrum. So depending on where you identify as a person, whether you're a cisgender male or somebody who is trans and identifies as male, Latino fits perfectly, but maybe you might be non-binary. And so Latinx really came about as a way to be inclusive of other gender identities within the Latino, Latina pluralism. I would just say those are identifying terms that can be used by anyone who identifies as such. But there's not really a correct term. Like things that have been defined for us, like Latino or Hispanic by the United States Census government, were done so in ways that are not as relevant as today's people who identify as Latine or Latinx.
So Central Coast Voices, you and your guests have talked about issues related to healthcare, social justice, and immigrant rights. Talk to us about your personal journey and how these issues and communities came to be important to you.
Well, it's a very personal issue for me as a mixed status family member. I grew up in an undocumented household. Both my parents came to the United States as immigrants, and my mom later petitioned for her naturalization and became a citizen in the early 2000s. And my dad passed away as a permanent resident in 2013. And so for me, this journey of immigrant discourse comes to just having grown up as somebody in a migrant household, in a migrant community, the migrant family, as somebody who is a citizen in a mixed status family, understand my privilege and being able to speak up and try to challenge the powers that be when it comes to advocating for immigrant rights.
Can you expand a little bit about that, going from somebody who has a lived experience and felt personally the challenges of undocumented immigrants to somebody who is an academic now and has made that a focus of their research mm-hmm. and their professional life? How was that transition and why did that take place?
So the transition came out of a need to know more about the quality of life of Latinx immigrants and indigenous peoples, particularly because my dad passed away of cancer. And so for me, I needed to believe that I wasn't going through it alone, and that my experience, that which was very challenging, navigating hospitals and doctors and illness and cancer diagnoses, was very new. But I needed to be grounded in at the same time as somebody who was trying to make my dad proud before he passed away. And then when I started to do the research and actually become a scholar of migration and health, it was because I wanted to help people understand that, yes, it is hard to navigate these systemic barriers to accessing healthcare, education, and housing and health insurance, but it's also our right to be able to participate in that way as a human being, to have access to healthcare. And so I began to talk to people in Guadalupe, California, at my sister's boyfriend's tire shop. And so I would, when I was in my PhD mm-hmm. program at UCSB, interview people about their barriers to healthcare and their fears. And I began to quickly realize that a lot of their sentiments that they were expressing were shared with my own experiences as being afraid of immigration customs enforcement, being deported. For example, my cousins had been deported a few times in their lives when I was younger, like growing up in Modesto, California, and also having experienced family come and go from Mexico to the U.S., either because they were afraid that they were going to be kicked out or they needed to risk making the journey to go see family and come back, hopefully. And so navigating that was very difficult because there wasn't a lot of stability in the home. But for my own personal quality of life, I was eligible, income eligible for Medi-Cal as a young person, but never opted in to get those benefits because my mom didn't want to share her personal identifying information with any government institution, whether it be state or federal. And so many people do experience that today, is second guessing themselves, if can I get in trouble for sharing this information? If I qualify for benefits, is it going to come back and harm my petition for naturalization? And so those are all very common experiences in the migrant community, is just being afraid that somehow, some way, your identity is going to get leaked and implicate yourself or your family.
While you were talking about your experience, I immediately connected with that, because there is this, and I don't know if it's a rumor or if it's true, but there is this paranoia, lack of a better word, is that if I take any benefits from the government, is that going to affect my status in the future? Mm-hmm. Is that going to work against me? Because even when I was applying, people were telling me you should not apply for Med-Cal, because if and when you do decide to become a citizen, that could count against you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's not true. Yeah, so yeah. Accessing Medi-Cal is not going to prevent you from becoming a citizen in the future. And that goes for our listeners, too. If your family is on the fence of applying for benefits, or for you, your siblings, or yourself, go for it, because it's there for you. We are seeing the benefits of making Medi-Cal accessible for all people that are income eligible, regardless of immigration status in California.
If you're just joining us, this is KCBX Public Radio, and this is Issues and Ideas. I'm speaking to Mario Espinoza-Kulik, faculty at the Ethnic Studies Department at Cuesta College and co-host of Central Coast Voices right here at KCBX.
What are some of the misperceptions about undocumented immigrants that you have come across in your work? And I would also like to add that there's a conflicting relationship between immigrants versus undocumented immigrants. Mm-hmm. Can you also talk about that?
Yeah. So in a migrant community, there are mixed statuses. So whether that be you're a green card holder or a naturalized citizen or a first-generation American born to someone who is a migrant, and you would be a citizen yourself. But it's very fluid. Some people will wait and wait and wait to get paperwork in order to become naturalized citizens. But some folks might not be eligible because of their age, like we saw with Dreamers and DACA. For folks that were born at a certain year, they were ineligible to benefit from DACA. And so there are different structures to help support people in the community, whether that be the United Farm Workers or Immigrant Legal Resource Center or Dream Centers at college campuses, that help people navigate that, not only for themselves, but for their families, because it is very complex.
Yeah, and also to clarify, when I say immigrants versus undocumented immigrants, what I was talking about is actually that within immigrant communities, people who have adopted the rhetoric of villainizing undocumented immigrants, especially in the current environment.
I've definitely seen that in the community firsthand, where people will talk down on people for not having their papers and say different negative things. But I would like to stress for people who are naturalized that you too came from an undocumented background into who you are today as a citizen of the United States. That came with real struggle, and you're part of a community that is still struggling. And so turning against each other is not going to do anyone any good, but extending the hand and saying, like, this is the resources that I use to get to where I am today, is a lot more productive than just name-calling people. And even something as simple as the word illegal, right? No human being is illegal. But in my community, people often say es ilegal or is illegal to identify somebody who is basically at a different stage of the migration process than they are. That doesn't mean that once you're illegal, you're going to stay illegal. Because like I said, no human's illegal. People are just undocumented until they are able to acquire whatever documents best suit their needs for where they're at. And so that looks different, right? There's people who have work visas with the H-1B program. There are folks who are on temporary work status who migrate for seasonal work. Or there are people who came here as children who are undocumented but might not even know about it yet. And some that recently found out. And that can be tricky too, because a lot of times it happens when you reach a milestone. Like, you want to apply for a job or you want to get a license, but you've never known your whole life that you were undocumented. And that can be very jarring. But like I said, there are resources to help people navigate that if that's your situation. But it's not uncommon.
How would somebody not know that they're undocumented? Are you talking about teenagers who then go on to...
Yes, I'm talking about teenagers, school-age children, people who their parents, just to protect their kids, don't talk about that part of their history of how they arrived here or if they came here as a child. I had friends in high school who arrived as children but didn't know until they were in high school that they were undocumented. And that was because their family never talked about it. And a lot of times that's because people were trying to keep each other protected. And that comes with its own tricky level of consequences, too, because sometimes that means not speaking your language, whether that's an indigenous language or Spanish, just for the sake of keeping up appearances that you are nothing more than American. And when that happens, it's important to find help to navigate what's appropriate, because it doesn't mean that you can't get a job. It doesn't mean that you can't get an education or access resources like health insurance. It just means that you need to get in contact with the right people.
There's something that I wanted to follow up on, just because this is something that keeps on coming up, which is this particular phrase. Immigrants often say, we came here legally and we put in money and resources to get into America legally. And then there are these immigrants, and I know I'm using derogatory language, but it's just to explain that this is what is said. And they have come in illegally and, you know, they're basically skipping the line.
Mm-hmm.
What do you say to that?
I think it's important to recognize that migration has been a common human experience before borders, before government, before crime and policy. And so it's a natural form of human movement. And so when somebody came here illegally or legally, really what that means is that their life circumstances had either put them in a situation where they ended up coming here illegally, whether they had a choice or not. And the people who do come here legally might have a different story, right? They might have access to different resources like education, where they can compete for a visa that is suitable for their work. Or they might have family in the States already that they can petition to bring people, like an immediate family member, like a parent. And something that's familiar to me is when you're 21, some folks in the American community that are citizens but their parents are not celebrate the 21st year by starting a petition for their parents to become citizens as well.
Mm-hmm.
So whether you arrived here legally or illegally, it is a matter of circumstance and priority. And the priority, unfortunately, has been complicated by immigration policy, especially border policy. So how we saw all that disrupted with Trump's administration before Biden, and then even during the Biden administration, where folks were camping out in border cities waiting to get petitioned. And I saw this documentary, I showed it for my class, where lawyers are advocating for migrants with disabilities at the border who may be blind or paralyzed or have some sort of cognitive disability or even poverty, right? These are all just reasons why people might migrate and petition for asylum and to become refugees, because they're trying to escape a lifestyle that is just uninhabitable. And so when I hear the distinctions of legal migration and illegal migration, mm-hmm. I think it still all just comes down to circumstance. What circumstances were you in to travel, quote unquote, illegally? Or what circumstances were you in to be able to jump into the line and wait for your turn?
Talking about the Central Coast, what have been the challenges that undocumented immigrants face?
In the Central Coast, undocumented immigrants face fear of retaliation from their employers, wage theft, especially if you're working in the agricultural industry, fear of deportation, and then also systemic racism. So these have been discussed about in studies that I've been a part of, like the enumeration study for the Latinx indigenous community in San Luis Obispo County. And in my own research on La Gente Unida, where I asked people also about their mental health and their anxiety.
Can you translate that for us?
The People United, or La Gente Unida. And so in that study, migrants on the Central Coast disclosed what their fears were. And we did some statistical analysis that showed that the association between fear of deportation and navigating language barriers to accessing healthcare and insurance correlated with having a higher anxiety score. Because in the Central Coast, it is deeply ingrained with how people decide how to put food on the table, how to pay rent, and what they need to do to make those ends meet. And many times people will put off their health only to work and bring in money to pay for their food for their family or formula for their babies, diapers, water, which we found out was also a big concern of people, particularly in North San Luis Obispo County.
Why is that?
Folks are suspicious of the water, the way it tastes and the way it looks. They identified that it either looks bad or smells bad or tastes bad. While there might not be substantial evidence that it is contaminated, I think it's important to at least acknowledge that migrants are buying bottled water to consume instead of solely relying to tap water. And so there's a lot of easy health policy solutions that could be taken to encourage safe water drinking habits, like, for example, providing water purification systems or analog water purifiers where you just pour the water and it purifies it yourself. But those are some examples of interventions that county governments have taken in addressing water concerns. Not San Luis Obispo County, I've not heard of them providing water purifiers for residents. But what I'm trying to say is that the concerns that the community shares are tangible concerns that can be mitigated through collaboration and communication across sectors.
And it's also about taking people seriously and their concerns seriously. Safe drinking water is a right for everyone. And mm-hmm. if they have these doubts, then they should be heard
yeah.
and investigated, at least.
We did get a lot of pushback from the county about the water issue. And I will reiterate that I think it is important that whether or not there is a legitimate contamination or concern, people should be listened to.
You just mentioned your research. How recent is that? And did you do it as part of Cuesta College?
Yes, I was affiliated with the Cuesta College Ethnic Studies Department as part of the study, and also worked with my husband and collaborator, Dr. Alex Espinoza-Kulik, with our firm Queer Profs, and Joel Derringer and Associates, as well as Dr. Bonnie Bade from CSU San Marcos. And so we worked as a group with the County of San Luis Obispo Public Health Department.
When?
Last year. We wanted to represent numbers of households, including children and people who were living and working in San Luis Obispo County.
And what are the main concerns right now for undocumented immigrants as they wait for Donald Trump to take over as president? And also, how are they preparing for what is to come?
So I had a great conversation with Assemblymember Don Addis yesterday on Central Coast Voices, and she reassured me that there are protections in place. For example, in California, we have the California Values Act, or Senate Bill 54, which limits state and local law enforcement's cooperation with federal immigration authorities. And so some of the fears and concerns are really around this narrative of deporting a million undocumented immigrants under Trump. And a lot of the discourse that has been on public news media has been damaging to the community, especially our mental health and our sense of security and safety. But this is something that is also really familiar, not just with Donald Trump's previous presidency and their upcoming presidency, but with folks like Reagan and Nixon and other presidential administrations. Immigration has been a central issue that divides bipartisan politics. And so for our Central Coast families that are immigrants, I can personally identify with some of the fears, which are people going to be denaturalized? Are first-generation Americans going to lose their birthright citizenship? Are my loved ones going to be deported? Like, those are the main concerns and questions that I keep hearing in my family and community. And realistically, it will take a lot to denaturalize somebody or remove somebody's birthright citizenship. And a lot of that is constitutionally protected and would require a supermajority to change much of those things. But I wouldn't say to be comfortable. I would advise people to feel safe and hold your family tight and fight at the same time. Reassuring our family members and friends that they are safe, that we are allies to them, and that we got their backs. And so that's one thing that I keep telling myself is find the hope, because that's one thing that folks like President-elect Donald Trump and their party and their incoming cabinet is good at is fear-mongering. And so I would just reassure people that in our political climate, you're not alone in fighting for your right to be here and to stay with your family. And another thing that people are afraid of is DACA. Like, students, for example, have always been uncertain about the status of DACA, whether or not it's going to continue. Are they going to be able to go to work and school? Things like that. That is still going to be the vibe. But at the same time, lean on the resources that are available to you now. If your university or college campus or school offers legal assistance, can answer your questions or your family's questions about immigration, I would take advantage of those resources now. Other things, lean on your local organizations who advocate for migrant communities, like Mixteco Indígena Community Organizing Project, Central Coast Alliance United for a Sustainable Economy, Importa, and Slow and DocuSupport.
How can we support folks, neighbors, friends who are undocumented?
I would say support communities that are undocumented through donations, through volunteering your time, and advocating for inclusive policies. If you see something that's maybe a school policy, for example, bilingual education or migrant education, and that might be something that's up for discussion on a board agenda, attend as a parent, attend as a student, attend as a concerned community member. If you are a part of the community, you might know somebody personally who's undocumented, your testimony is very valuable to protecting your loved ones. And that could be something that you read as public comment at a city council meeting, or advocating for something like a sanctuary policy, wherever you may be. I think the time is now to educate ourselves about how we can use our platforms, whether big or small, and how to challenge these harmful narratives in our circles. One of the things that I wanted to bring up, we did a study of, I believe, thousands of news stories on the Central Coast, where we did a network analysis of newspaper rhetoric and immigration policy, and we saw that headlines and public discourse that was more central around anti-immigrant narratives actually helped to sustain and create anti-immigrant policy. And so basically, in public discussion on the news media, using water-based terms like surge and wave are actually associated with more harsh characterizations of migrants and as threatening outsiders. This was last year, but it was a little bit higher 3 years ago when people were talking about migrants coming to the border. And they would say things like uptick or wave or surge. And so things that create like an urgency, like you have to head for the hills to avoid the tsunami, right? Like that's sort of like what I'm trying to communicate here is that when we are talking about surges of people, it sounds like we're flooding the gates and it has real effects.
And fear.
And fear. The unfortunate effect is that those news media stories that continue to use subtle instances of xenophobia and racially charged terms actually fuel anti-immigrant policy, which I think to me was very surprising. It's not really my strength. It's my husband's strength in social network analysis. And so we put our brains together to see, like, what would that show?
Is there anything else that you would like to add?
I was talking with Assemblymember Dawn Addis, and I asked her for an example of what are we doing right when it comes to collaborating with between the federal government, state government, or local government. And what was mentioned was disaster relief is being done right. So California's government was very proactive in gaining dollars back to taxpayers and also working proactively with the federal government under Biden so that when we do have natural disasters, everyone is protected, including folks who are undocumented. So I think the last thing that I will say is just hold each other close, undocumented or not. We're going to need to have each other's back for the next 4 years.
Thank you, Mario, for joining us. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Meher.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eister composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Meher Ali. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments at kcbx.org.